Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the last of the three lectures to be given by Professor Lewis in the series put on by the Stickard, the Suntory Toyota Foundation, and I think it's appropriate that I should express my personal gratitude to them for the financial support which has made Professor Lewis's visit possible, and to remind you that in due time a record of these lectures, suitably revised, no doubt, in the light of the criticism, such criticism as has been levelled at them, will be published by Cambridge University Press under the joint imprint of the Centre of International Studies at LSE and Cambridge. We can look forward to that, and that is in hand. I've introduced Professor Lewis twice already, so I'm not going to do it again. I'm just going to ask him to deliver his final lecture in the series. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Watt. Harold Macmillan once reflected, long after the event, that collusion would not have been disreputable if Antony hadn't said it wasn't true. There is a good deal to be said for this point of view. Eden would have saved himself much grief had he not lied about it in the House of Commons. The alternative might have been for him to regard cooperation with the French and the Israelis as a necessary and justifiable part of the military operation, to have taken more of his colleagues and permanent officials into his confidence, and to have publicly refused to say anything about it. It is possible to imagine Macmillan pursuing this course of action and emerging with more of his reputation intact than did Macmillan. As it transpired, Eden, from the time of his meeting with the two Frenchmen on 14 October 1956, seems to have regarded collusion as a potentially dishonorable step. The two French emissaries were General Maurice Chasles, the air deputy to the French chiefs of staff, and Albert Gazière, a minister of labor and a confidant of Guy Mollet. Mollet himself had telephoned to say that they would be communicating a secret message expressing his own views. According to Chasles' later account, there was a distinct hypocrisy about Eden's manifest anxiety not to be the aggressor. Since the French proposed, in effect, to attack the victim of aggression, and since Eden's reputation rested on the principles of collective security and the sanctity of treaties, above all, on the public commitment to the Covenant of the League and the Charter of the UN, one can understand Eden's emotions. The plan was to encourage Israel to attack Egypt across the Sinai Peninsula. Britain and France would then issue an ultimatum to both sides to withdraw their forces from the immediate area of the canal. Britain and France would then intervene on grounds of separating the two combatants and of saving the canal itself from ruin. British and French forces would occupy the canal zone as a police measure and secure the terminal points at both ends as well as other key points. The canal would be restored to Anglo-French or international management. The reservists would not have to be demobilized. The crisis could finally be decisively resolved. Most important of all, there now existed a justification for intervention. Eden was, according to Antony Nutting, thrilled at the idea, but he did not commit himself. He would consult with the members of the cabinet, meaning, first of all, the Egypt Committee. Before the meeting with the two Frenchmen, Eden and Nutting had discussed the situation in Jordan, which they believed was the actual purpose of the visit. It fell to Nutting, as Minister of State at the Foreign Office, to assist Eden, since the Foreign Secretary was in New York debating with the Egyptians whether a compromise might be possible after all. A few days earlier, the Israelis had delivered a stunning attack against a Jordan police station at Qaqilia in retaliation for the murder of two Israeli farm laborers. The massive, punitive strike seemed entirely out of proportion to the incident. Now, we now know that the Israeli strike was a feint in preparation for an attack against Egypt, but it did set off a chain reaction east of the River Jordan. Iraqi forces mobilized to support Jordan. If Iraqi troops crossed the frontier into Jordan, Israel would probably go to war, or so the Israelis led the French and the British to believe. Jordan was still a British client state, despite the sacking of General Glubb. The question was whether the British would fulfill the treaty obligation to come to Jordan's aid, thereby becoming involved in a war with Israel at the moment of crisis with Egypt. Eden, for one, was emphatic in his response. He said to Antony Nutting, "I will not allow you to plunge this country into war merely to satisfy the anti-Jewish spleen of you people in the Foreign Office." Well, the two Frenchmen played on Eden's anxiety that the Israelis might attack the wrong enemy. In their present mood, who could predict what the Israelis might do? This line of reasoning actually strengthened Eden's own hand in presenting the case to the Egypt Committee in the cabinet. The Israelis were preparing for war. If they were to attack the Egyptians, then they would provide the pretext for intervention. There is an irony here. The French, and to a certain extent the Israelis, needed Eden as much as he needed them. The French had already supplied Israel with military equipment, including 75 Mystère fighter aircraft. The Israelis could take Sinai, but they faced the prospect of retaliation on Israeli cities by the Egyptians using Soviet airplanes that would approach from the sea before Israeli fighters could intercept them. French aircraft could not reach Cairo. Only the British, using bases in Aden and Cyprus, had the capacity to knock out the Egyptian Air Force. Eden was thus the key figure in the plan to attack Egypt. He now held the balance in the decision to intervene or not to intervene. Eden's tendency to hesitate did not now plague him. He moved forward as if knowing that there would be no turning back. At a meeting of the Egypt Committee on 16 October, Eden began to unfold the plan, perhaps in more detail than he later thought wise. Richard Lamb, who wrote the first book on Eden and the crisis based on the recently released documents at the Public Record Office, has contributed to our knowledge of this critical period, as well as to our understanding of the military planning. Butler was not present at this meeting because of an appointment with the Queen. Salisbury was ill with heart trouble, and the key figures among those present were Monckton and Kilmure. Kilmure always vigorously supported Eden until the very last. Monckton sometimes dissented, but always acquiesced. Eden described the conversation at Chequers with the two Frenchmen. The committee then endorsed Eden's proposal to say to Guy Mollet that the plan could move forward. This was probably the critical decision. The word probably is necessary because Eden ordered the minutes of the meeting to be suppressed and not entered into the record. He may have felt that he had been too candid, even within the secret confines of the Egypt Committee. In any event, Eden had crossed the Rubicon, if indeed he had not already done so in the meeting with the two Frenchmen. Now, there were further irregularities, or at least extremely odd procedures, besides the suppression of the records. At Chequers, neither the French ambassador in London nor the British ambassador in Paris had been present, even though Sir Gladwin Jebb, by coincidence, had been in London at the time. Eden instructed Nutting to inform only three officials within the Foreign Office, Sir Ivan Kirkpatrick, Patrick Dean, the Assistant Undersecretary and Chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, and Archibald Ross, the Assistant Secretary in charge of the Middle East. Eden specifically told Nutting to exclude the legal advisor at the Foreign Office, Sir Gerald Fitzmaurice. "That's the last person I want consulted," Eden exclaimed. "The lawyers are always against our doing anything. For God's sake, keep them out of it. This is a political affair." Lord Kilmore was the exception. By having the Lord Chancellor in the cabinet, Eden could rely on him for legal opinion. Kilmore was among Eden's staunchest supporters. Within minutes after the meeting with the French visitors on Sunday, the 14th of October, Eden telephoned Selwyn Lloyd in New York to summon him back to London. Lloyd did not wish to return. He was actually on the verge of reaching a compromise arrangement with the Egyptian foreign minister, whereby Egypt would reach a cooperative agreement with the canal's users. Eden then insisted that Lloyd return. He believed that the Egyptians were merely stalling for time, and Foster Dulles had further outraged him by proposing that 90% of the canal's tolls go to Egypt. Dulles seemed to suggest that Egypt should actually be the beneficiary from the crisis. Dulles thus contributed to pushing Eden over the edge. Lloyd reluctantly arrived back in London on the 16th of October and then accompanied Eden to Paris on the same day to meet with Guy Mollet and the French Foreign Minister Christian Pinault. Jeb was again excluded, and so also was Netting, who had protested against the French proposal. Eden accepted in principle the French plan, including the coordination of military arrangements with the Israelis. Eden had evoked the loyalty of his foreign secretary. Lloyd had returned from New York optimistic about the prospects for a settlement. He had initially responded adversely to the French plan. Nutting, who intensely disliked the scheme, believed that Lloyd might be the one person to stop Eden at this stage. Nutting indeed told Lloyd that he himself would resign if the plan were carried out. He hoped that Lloyd might influence Eden to change course. In the event, Eden managed to persuade Lloyd that the proposed principles for a settlement had no more value than Neville Chamberlain's piece of paper. The analogies of the 1930s still held a powerful grip on Eden's intellect. Nasser was attempting to undermine the pro-British Arab states. He had to be stopped, now or never, especially in view of worsening weather conditions in the Mediterranean. Lloyd agreed with this analysis and, more reluctantly, with the reorientation of British alliances. In the words of Hugh Thomas, whose book, The Suez Affair, stands up remarkably well after a quarter of a century, Eden had nailed Britain's colors to the unfamiliar mast of Franco-Israeli collaboration. Eden and Lloyd now formed a united front in the cabinet. In a critical meeting on 18 October, after the return from Paris, Lloyd reported on the Security Council proceedings. Despite the tangible progress, he expressed doubt whether the Egyptians would ever agree to anything tolerable to the British. Eden described the results of the discussion in Paris. He related how the situation would now become complicated if Israel attacked Jordan. In his conversations with the French, he said, he had proceeded on the basis that every possible effort should be made to ensure that the Israelis should not at this stage attack Jordan. If the Israelis did contemplate any military operations against the Arabs, it would be far better from our point of view that they should attack Egypt, and I have reason to believe that if they make any military move, it will be made in that direction. There was no dissent from Eden's analysis. In this and in later cabinet discussions, the critical question is, did Eden deceive or mislead the cabinet? Were there stages of deception, or were there progressive stages of candor? Eden himself, in retrospect, emphasized the gravity of the discussions. Every senior member of the government remembered the mood in which we had taken our first decisions. The others were their consequence. Eden now responded to the arrival in France of the Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion at a meeting of the senior ministers summoned by Eden at Chequers on 22 October, it was decided that Lloyd should travel secretly to France to meet with the French and the Israelis. This is the first of several meetings that have or had an air of conspiracy about it, especially in retrospect, for it is clear from the documents at the Public Record Office that all records concerning this mission were meant to be suppressed. Only indirect traces can be found in the official documents. So who was at the meeting that decided to send the Foreign Secretary on the secret assignment? What did they have in mind? Well, Macmillan was there. He was still the most belligerently minded of all ministers, and Butler's presence was also especially significant. Apart from Eden himself, Butler was the most influential senior figure in the cabinet. Eden needed his assent, but it kept him on the fringes, as far as possible, of the Egypt Committee. Butler now participated in the decision to dispatch Lloyd to France. Anthony Head, previously Minister for War, had replaced Monckton as Minister of Defense. Head had been one of the principal figures in the 1954 base agreement. He had a steady mind and an immense capacity for hard work and difficult assignments. He supported the decision. So too, not surprisingly, did Lord Kilmer. General Keighley, as well as Sir Norman Brooke, were also at the meeting. There could have been no doubt in any of their minds that the Foreign Secretary was being dispatched to discuss with the Israelis, as well as the French, the invasion of Egypt and the downfall of Nasser. So did these members of the cabinet merely regard the mission as a necessary, if disagreeable, piece of business, or something more? Where does one draw the line between ethical and unethical action in the business of collusion? Collusion later acquired an especially pejorative connotation because it implied preparation for a war of aggression as well as public misrepresentation. So far, these members of the cabinet would certainly have maintained that they had done nothing wrong. Lloyd left for France on the next day, the 23rd, and returned the day after on the 24th after meeting with the French and the Israelis at Sèvres, a suburb of Paris. Lloyd at this stage did not believe that the plan could be carried out. The Israelis had made unrealistic demands. With somewhat mixed and frustrated emotions, Eden announced to the cabinet on the same day that there had been important developments. It is necessary to reconstruct his remarks from fragmentary evidence because most of the documents concerning this cabinet meeting have been amended. One record of the cabinet meeting does contain the phrase secret conversations with representatives of the Israeli and French governments. Eden knew that Ben-Gurion had insisted that the British commit themselves to a joint force. Eden did not say, however, that Lloyd had met with Ben-Gurion and had discussed the terms of collaboration. Eden merely stated that it now appeared, I quote, that the Israelis will not alone launch a full-scale attack against Egypt. Well, was Eden deceiving the members of the cabinet by not disclosing the full details? He certainly could have been more frank, as some of the junior ministers remarked at the time. On the other hand, he may well have perceived that some ministers preferred not to become too closely involved with military plans. And he was certainly aware that full disclosure of Lloyd's conversation at Sèvres would excite controversy and would probably divide the cabinet. Eden was moving at different levels of ambiguity, well aware, as one junior minister put it, that there were various layers of knowledge. He did not press for a decision at this meeting. On this and on other occasions, the cabinet minutes give the impression of Eden's adept handling of the discussion. He left the question open, saying that the French foreign minister would arrive later in the day with further news. Pinault did indeed relate yet another new development. The Israelis, still at Sav, had now agreed to launch the attack if the British and French would agree to intervene with the purpose of separating the two combatants. This was roughly the original plan that Eden had hoped for. The Israelis would initiate the war. Ben-Gurion's condition was that the British agree to an airstrike to take out the Egyptian Air Force. So Eden now took the plunge. He dispatched Patrick Dean, along with Donald Logan, Lloyd's private secretary, to serve to ensure that the Israeli attack would be significant enough to justify intervention. Now, this episode, of course, is well known. Dean put his signature to a document that became known as the Protocol of Sèvres. He returned to London to report to Eden, who was appalled that Dean had signed a document. Eden had wished everything to be done in utter secrecy with no written evidence of the collusion. He ordered Dean and Logan back to Paris to persuade the French to destroy all of copies. The French refused, as did the Israelis, after contact was established with them in Tel Aviv. The Israelis regarded a written agreement as the only guarantee that the British would actually intervene. The document itself represented what the Americans call a smoking gun. Sooner or later, it would be discovered, but even without it, the cumulative evidence would be overwhelming. The question turns on why Eden attached so much significance to it. It was the attempt to suppress the document as much as its existence that damaged Eden's reputation. The issue of Eden and the attempted destruction of documents leads to an even more basic question. Why did Eden pursue this subterranean course? The answer goes beyond the difficulty, if not the impossibility, of persuading some of his colleagues. Caught up in the momentum of the crisis, Eden believed that if the operation succeeded, its flaws or questionable tactics would be forgotten or at least overlooked. The difference between success and failure in an operation such as Suez is the difference between victor and vanquished. Even as victor, of course, Eden would have faced nagging questions, but he would have been able to argue far more effectively that extraordinary measures had been necessary. Eden did take the cabinet increasingly into his confidence. At a meeting on 24 October, the day after his conversation with the French foreign minister, and the same day that Dean signed the secret document at Sèvres, Eden outlined the plan for an Anglo-French military operation to seize the canal zone after a preliminary air bombardment designed to eliminate the Egyptian Air Force. He revealed that Israel would make a full-scale attack against Egypt. After the occupation of the canal zone, the goal would be the downfall of Colonel Nasser's regime in Egypt. In the course of the discussion, a basic question was put to the Prime Minister. What of the response of the other Arab countries? I quote, "Is it not likely that such an operation will unite the Arab world in support of Egypt?" At this point, Eden quite skillfully and passionately deployed his arguments against Nasser. The Prime Minister said that this was a serious risk, but against it must be set the greater risk that unless early action could be taken to damage Colonel Nasser's prestige, his influence would be extended throughout the Middle East to a degree which would make it much more difficult to overthrow him. It was known that he was already plotting coups in many of the other Arab countries, and we should never have a better pretext for intervention against him than we had now as a result of his seizure of the Suez Canal. Well, the point is that Eden himself had emphasized the pretext. The opportunity of the moment might not come again, and to most of those at the meeting, the grand plan was breathtaking in its bold design. The cabinet discussion carried over into the next day, the 25th of October, when Eden now put his cards on the table. "We must face the risk," he stated, that we shall be accused of collusion with Israel, but this charge is liable to be brought against us in any event, and it is preferable that we should be seen to be holding the balance between Israel and Egypt rather than appear to be accepting Israeli cooperation in an attack on Egypt alone. Eden himself thus raised the issue of collusion, but he did not reveal the extent to which Britain was now committed to concerted action with the French and the Israelis. Did he need to be explicit? Did not ministers read between the lines? On this and on other occasions, Eden was certainly not lacking in frankness about the dangers to be faced. He did encounter, as one might expect in so serious a matter, some fierce opposition. In the cabinet meeting the previous day, he had been challenged, probably by Walter Monckton, on the likely response of the Arabs and whether or not the invasion would have the opposite of the intended effect by uniting the Arab world against Britain. Eden seems generally to have carried the cabinet against that point by successfully arguing the danger of Nasser's subversive activities. He now had to face questions on the response of the United States. Would the invasion not do lasting damage to Anglo-American relations? The minutes do not mention Macmillan's previous misguided assessment that Ike would lie doggo, but this advice must have helped to reassure some ministers who believed that the Americans would tacitly support the strike against Egypt while having their own reasons not to be publicly associated with it. In fact, the concern for the American response seems to have mainly preoccupied a relatively junior figure in the cabinet, Derek Heathcote Amory, the Minister for Agriculture. Amory, during the war, had been severely wounded after the paratroop drop at Arnhem, and perhaps he had reservations about the military plan as well. He later became High Commissioner to Canada. His significance in the Suez affair is that he definitely voiced reservations about the plan of action because of the repercussions it would have on Anglo-American relations. On that point, he was more far-sighted than anyone else in the cabinet, but he was too junior a figure to carry effective influence. The prevailing sentiment seems to have been that the Americans would not protest, and there was also undoubtedly the feeling that it was time that Britain proved that she could still act independently from the United States. Eden faced basic criticism as well on the proposition that Britain and France would intervene to separate the two antagonists. Ministers called attention to the absurd proposition of Britain and France calling for the two warring powers to withdraw from 10 miles of the canal. The Egyptians would be withdrawing, of course, in their own territory. The members of the cabinet responded to the plan in exactly the same way as did Eisenhower and Dulles when, a few days later, they learned of the actual ultimatum to Egypt and Israel. Could there be any more clear demonstration of collusion? With considerable understatement, the cabinet minutes read, "We should not appear to be holding the balance evenly between Israel and Egypt." And there were other troublesome points. What of the tripartite agreement of 1950, by which Britain, France, and the United States had pledged to uphold the frontiers of the Middle East? What, above all, of the United Nations? Even if Britain and France justified their action on the immediacy of the problem, should they not then refer the question to the Security Council? It is perhaps significant that Lord Salisbury was still ill and absent from this particularly critical discussion when Eden, supported by the tenacious Selwyn Lloyd, again carried the meeting. The sense of boldness and indeed brilliance of the plan seemed greater even greater than in the meeting on the day before. Despite serious reservations on such important points as the response of the rest of the Arab world, of the United States, and of the United Nations, the proposal, as presented by Eden, was endorsed by his colleagues. I quote from the cabinet minutes. The cabinet agreed in principle that in the event of an Israeli attack on Egypt, the government should join with the French government in calling on the two belligerents to stop hostilities and withdraw their forces to a distance of 10 miles from the canal, and should warn both belligerents that if either or both of them failed to undertake within 12 hours to comply with these requirements, British and French forces would intervene in order to enforce compliance. Eden had clearly deceived the cabinet on the extent of British commitment with the French and the Israelis, but whatever might be said of his presentation of the case and his withholding of vital information, the cabinet had made a collective decision. Ministers knew that they were becoming parties to collusion. It was only the extent of the collusion that remained concealed. Eden himself had used the very word. As Robert Rhodes James has put it, and he is right on this point, none could possibly claim that he was deceived or did not know what he was consenting to. It was plainly a conspiracy. It may well have been a justified conspiracy, but there was no doubting what it was. Now, it was a curious and loosely organized conspiracy. Bold plans often appear more brilliant at the time than in retrospect. Eden's grand strategy soon revealed basic flaws. If he had possessed more backing in the cabinet, it might perhaps have been possible for the British and the French to have planned more thoroughly with the Israelis. It might well have been possible to have had British and French paratroops dropped along the distance of the entire canal with the support from Israeli land troops and armor, tank forces. On the British side of the operation, it might have been possible for the expedition to have sailed earlier from Malta, thus arriving in the Eastern Mediterranean ready for action at the time of the ultimatum, rather than with the awkward gap of 6 days. If it had been assumed from the beginning that the goal to retake the canal and to topple Nasser had priority, as in time of war, then the chain of events might have been different. But Eden could not act in open defiance of the UN Charter. He became a prisoner of his cover story that there had been no collusion. The problem was that the fiction did not fit the operational plan because, as it transpired, the Israelis achieved most of their objectives, even as the British Armada sailed from Malta. Eden was trapped by his own faulty strategy. By the time the expeditionary force arrived, there was no fire left to be put out. Until the last moment, General Keighley did not even know of the plan for coordinated action. Eden kept the compartments of policy and military action tightly sealed and separated, nor did he willingly accept political advice from his military advisors. When Keighley asked him whether in the end Britain would be better off as a result of the proposed action, Eden lost his temper. Up to the time of the Israeli assault on 31 October, he became increasingly irascible, though with moments of what appeared to some observers to be an unnatural calm. He repeated the phrase, like in the war, as if recalling that he had been through equally severe tests before. On the 1st of November, Julian Amory wrote in his diary, "The morning papers have announced an Israeli attack on Egypt. My immediate reaction was that this was the heaven-sent opportunity for armed intervention. My next thought, that Eden would never have the guts to do it. The more I thought about it, the more I became sure that we must intervene, and the more doubtful whether we would." Later that day, Julian Amory traveled to Manchester, where he participated in a BBC discussion on the crisis in the Middle East with what he called left-wing intellectuals from Manchester University. After the talk, they adjourned for a drink and listened to the news. Julian Amory's diary continues, "My wildest hopes have been confirmed. The Suez policy, Suez Group policy, has been at last accepted. Here is the great chance to restore our position in the Middle East and start building again for the future. Now, Eden, at the very same time, used virtually the same words to explain the military action to Eisenhower. An opportunity for a fresh start. But unfortunately for Eden, a delay in the initial communication caused Eisenhower to learn of the British and French ultimatum on the ticker tape and in the newspapers rather than firsthand from the Prime Minister's office. It is important to bear in mind that this stage of the Suez Crisis coincided with the beginning of the Hungarian uprising. To Eisenhower, and especially Foster Dulles, the deflection of public attention from Hungary to Suez was one of the unforgivable consequences of the British and the French action, or so it seemed at the time. In fact, the Suez Crisis probably worked to Dulles' advantage, because otherwise the hollowness of the phrase, rolling back the Iron Curtain in Eastern Europe, would have become more obvious. Eisenhower and Dulles, at first, did not know the extent of British commitment to the French and the Israelis. Eden had given instructions that the Americans systematically be denied information about the operation. Eden worked on the lethal assumption that the Americans would do nothing. Now, perhaps Eisenhower and Dulles could have been more alert to clues provided by the intelligence services. In any event, they hoped on the first day of the Israeli attack that there still might be a chance to unhook the British from the invasion. To Eisenhower, the French were merely behaving true to form, but he had expected better from the British. The Anglo-French ultimatum issued to the Israelis and the Egyptians on the second day of the fighting, the 30th of October, lifted the veil of camouflaged intent. Eisenhower and Dulles now had no doubt that the British were acting in concert with the French and the Israelis. What rankles most, according to the British Chargé d'Affaires in Washington, is what the Americans believe to be deliberate concealment on our part, if not an actual plot, with the French and the Israelis. The president was genuinely offended. He made it clear to Eden in various messages that in contrast to the governments of Britain and France, we, the government of the United States, are a government of honor and stick by what we say. Far from concurring that a fresh start might be possible, Eisenhower believed that Eden was trying to turn the clock back to the 19th century. Eisenhower regarded the British action as so bizarre and out of character that he asked himself whether Eden's decision might have been influenced by Churchill. The American ambassador at the UN, Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., immediately, on the 30th of October, introduced a resolution in the Security Council calling for a cessation of hostilities. It now fell to Sir Pearson Dixon, the British representative at the UN, and his French colleague, to veto the resolution sponsored by the United States. It was the first veto ever cast by Britain at the United Nations. The special relationship was in disarray. The Russian representative then proposed that all UN members should refrain from the use of force. The British and the French vetoed that resolution as well. For Dixon, this was a severe test. He was not merely committed to the principles of the UN, but had served as Eden's principal private secretary in the critical period of planning for the creation of the UN during the latter part of the Second World War. The Anglo-French vetoes, moreover, outraged Dag Hammarskjöld, Secretary General of the United Nations, who believed that the future of the UN itself was now at stake. Dixon's colleagues at the UN now treated him as a pariah. Eden had a high opinion of Dixon, who sustained the ordeal with remarkable self-restraint, though at times he appeared drawn and wan, as if he suffered from an ordeal that inwardly tore him apart. A few days later, Dixon expressed succinctly to Eden the problem of the exposed British position in New York. "I do not see how we can carry much conviction in our protests against the Russian bombing of Budapest if we ourselves are bombing Cairo." The Anglo-French use of the veto triggered Hugh Gaitskill's protest in the House of Commons. But as with Eisenhower, there was more to Gaitskill's attitude than met the eye. Eden announced on 4:30 p.m. on the 30th of October in the House of Commons that refusal by Egypt and Israel to adhere to the ultimatum would lead to Anglo-French military action. He had timed the announcement to avoid being stopped by the Americans, and he used the same calculation to avert opposition from the Labor Party. Gaitskill learned of the ultimatum only 15 minutes beforehand. Eden did not trust Gaitskill, as he had Attlee. Gaitskill, on the other hand, never believed that Eden would take so drastic a step without consultation. Gaitskill exclaimed to Douglas Jay, "I shall never believe anything that Eden says to me in public or in private." The next day in the House of Commons, Gaitskill began the attack in a theme that he pursued in intensity and eloquence over the next few weeks. He denounced Eden for betraying the United States, the Commonwealth, and the United Nations. "I must now tell the government and the country," Gaitskill stated, "that we cannot support the action they have taken, and that we shall feel bound by every constitutional means at our disposal to oppose it." The Suez story is filled with ironies, not the least of which is that Gaitskill's three areas of betrayal were a mirror reflection of Eden's own principles, three principles of foreign policy. The three principles were also the same as those emphasized in a statement signed by 335 members of Oxford Senior Common Rooms a few days later. "We consider that this action endangers the solidarity of the Commonwealth, that it constitutes a grave strain on the Atlantic Alliance, and that it is a flagrant violation of the principles of the UN Charter." Eden had made himself vulnerable to a collective attack by those who did not necessarily agree on priorities, but who passionately believed that one or more of the three principles had been placed in jeopardy. Even Luard, a young member of the Foreign Office who resigned as a result of Suez, perhaps best expressed the sentiment that Eden found the most troubling. "I belong to a generation," Luard wrote in his letter of resignation, "which was brought up in the belief that for one nation to undertake the use of armed force against another in order to promote its own interest is morally wrong. I grew up during a war which, I understood, was fought for the establishment of that principle." Luard, in other words, belonged to the generation that had placed faith in the United Nations. The embracing of the ideals of the UN was not, of course, universal, but it was widespread and it was passionate. It cut across countries as well as generations. John Foster Dulles, as well as Gaitskill, had each made the equivalent of a personal commitment to the UN Charter. The United Nations was at the heart of the matter. On the night of 31 October and the morning of the 1st, the air assault began. British bombers attacked 9 airfields around Cairo, yet there had been no declaration of war. On 1 November in the House of Commons, the Speaker suspended the session when Eden, in hesitant language, was unable to explain the status of British airmen engaged in combat with a country with which diplomatic relations had not yet been broken. After the House reconvened, Eden collected himself and stated calmly and authoritatively that there had been no declaration of war, but that troops in armed conflict were covered by the Geneva Convention. He added, as if trying to assure the House that Britain had not abandoned the United Nations, that after separating the combatants, no one could be more pleased than he if the UN were to take over maintaining the peace. Eden was caught up in the turmoil of the debate, It could be that he did not fully recognize the significance of his statement until after he had made it. The commitment to hand over to the United Nations was one of his critical decisions. If Eden faced widespread criticism, he possessed vocal and equally passionate support. The anti-Nasser sentiment in England crossed not merely class divisions, but party lines. 10 Downing Street was deluged with telegrams in favor of the military operation, as well as many who opposed it. Intellectually and legally, it was argued that Nasser had violated international agreements and that Britain should act with force to uphold the Charter of the United Nations, a dubious argument. But in any event, there were many who believed that Britain was justified in protecting her own interests. That was the line followed, for example, by Lord Kumar, and it was upheld by conservatives and others throughout the country. Eden also found substantial support among ex-servicemen who had experienced disagreeable encounters with the Jippos during the war. Rhodes James writes of the popular attitude in a way, I believe it fair to say, he shares to some extent himself. The British people cared little for niceties and wanted Nasser toppled and our canal returned to its rightful owners. The British, like the French, were fed up with humiliations from megalomaniac tin-pot dictators. The vote of confidence in the House of Commons was won by 270 to 218 votes. After faltering in the debate over whether or not Britain was at war, Eden, after the suspension of the session, had risen to the occasion and had powerfully stated the case for intervention. He received rousing cheers, and the opinion polls of early November, they can be read in different ways, but on the whole, Eden's general popularity actually increased. Eden's position was now more precarious, however, than it appeared to many of his supporters. The initial airstrikes had failed to topple Nasser. They had failed to trigger a revolution. They rather created the opposite effect of strengthening Egyptian resistance and mobilizing critics in London, New York, and throughout the world. The element of time now began to count against Eden. The bulk of the Armada of 100 ships did not sail from Malta until 2 days after the Israeli attack and the expiration of the ultimatum on the 31st of October, though some ships, by one pretext or another, had already left. The fleet lumbered across the Mediterranean at 5 knots on a 6-day voyage, as if anticipating battle with the equivalent of German panzer divisions. But the Israeli units were quickly achieving their objectives. No one had anticipated such a rapid outcome. No one had thought of the questions that might arise out of the Israeli success. Could Eden hold the UN at bay while British troops crossed the Mediterranean? Could he hold his own against the opposition in England? No one seems to have anticipated the most basic question of all. What would he do if the Israelis, having achieved their aims, accepted a ceasefire, thereby destroying the British pretext for intervention? If the vote in the House of Commons seemed precariously close for Eden, the one in the United Nations was devastatingly lopsided. On the 2nd of November, the General Assembly, where no veto is possible, debated whether or not to call for a ceasefire. Foster Dulles, speaking extemporaneously and with great emotion in the greatest speech of Dulles' career, stated with heavy heart that he found himself opposed to the actions of the two ancient allies of the United States. Dulles' speech marked the absolute condemnation of Britain and specifically of the policy of Sir Anthony Eden. The vote was 64-5, with only Australia and New Zealand supporting France, Britain, and Israel. You should know, Dixon warned Eden, that even our close friends here are becoming intensely worried at the possible consequences which might follow if we and the French remain for long in open defiance of the United Nations. So on the evening of the 3rd November, Eden made a television appearance to present his case to the nation. The radio carried his voice to the troops in the Middle East, including those sailing towards Port Said. His words were solemn and reassuring. "All my life," he explained, "I've been a man of peace, working for peace, striving for peace, negotiating for peace. I've been a League of Nations man and a United Nations man, and I'm still the same man with the same convictions and the same devotion to peace. I couldn't be other, even if I wished, but I'm utterly convinced that the action we have taken is right." Well, now, this was an impressive performance. The Prime Minister spoke not only with assurance, but with force and candor. His obvious sincerity of purpose and the plea for unity rallied many to his cause, but there were probably as many more who were repelled. Keith Kyle, in one of his superb miniature portraits, relates how Christopher Chancellor, the chairman of Reuters, hurled his glass of whiskey at the television screen, which in 1956 was quite a remarkable thing to do. Eden's message, at any rate, was very clear. The mistakes of the 1930s made by Neville Chamberlain in pursuing a policy of appeasement must not be repeated. Now was the time to act against a dictator who threatened Britain's presence in the Middle East. To a remarkable degree, Eden managed to convey the impression that he had reconciled two distinct principles. One was the pursuit of Britain's traditional aim in the great game in the East. The other was her commitment to the League and now the United Nations. These were, in fact, the two dominant and contradictory themes of Eden's career. The tension between them now mounted. On the same day that Eden appeared on television, a young assistant lecturer in international relations at the LSE, Hedley Bull, wrote to his parents in Australia about the course of events in England. I quote from Hedley's letter at length, because I believe it reveals not only the contradictory themes in Eden's thought, but also the atmosphere at the LSE during the Suez Crisis. I'm grateful to Mary Bull for this letter. "It is very difficult to think of anything at the moment but the crisis in Egypt. In my opinion, this is the greatest disaster in British foreign policy since the Munich Affair of 1938. I am sure that the majority of the people here are hostile to the British attack on Egypt, and I fervently hope that some conservative supporters will have the courage to throw out the Eden government." Now, I'll not interrupt with much editorial comment, but in fairness to Eden, there probably was much more support for him than Hedley seems to suggest. "Eden has committed himself to war and cannot draw back. What has already taken place has ruined British prestige beyond all hope of repair. But if Eden could be overthrown, there could at least be an abandonment of any further military action. The government is not doing what it claims to be doing, i.e. restoring order in the Middle East. Israel attacked Egypt. The British action is now to join with Israel in attacking the victim. There is no attempt to separate the Egyptians and the Israelis. The Suez Canal, which is being attacked by Britain and France, is 100 miles behind the Egyptian lines. Nor is Britain protecting the Suez Canal. There was no danger to the traffic through the canal till she herself began to attack it." Now, the comment about the safety of the canal was perceptive, for at about this time, the Egyptians began sinking ships with concrete to block the passage. The main channel through which Britain received oil was now blocked. Tankers from the Middle East would have to ply round the Cape. In the meanwhile, oil would have to be purchased from the Americans. Sterling was already in flight. Dollars would be the required currency. Hedley Bull's letter continues about the United Nations. "The British action has virtually destroyed the United Nations. It has no justification in international law or morality. All of this I could forgive if it could be shown that at least British interests were being advanced by the action. It can be argued that Britain for some months has been waiting for an opportunity to attack Egypt reoccupied the Canal Zone and caused the downfall of the Nasser regime. Now, this too was a perceptive remark and deserves to be emphasized because it reveals the transparent nature of Eden's motives as seen by an astute observer at the time. Headley then commented on the overriding, or what he called the real motive, of the government, who have welcomed the Israeli attack on Egypt as giving them the opportunity they have been waiting for. He did not draw the conclusion of collusion, but he was clear that the action fails to satisfy even the criterion of political expediency. Here is the heart of his analysis. It is to Britain's interest that Egypt should be humiliated, but the achievement of this objective is not worth jeopardizing the Anglo-American alliance, giving Britain the reputation in the world of being an aggressor nation, a reputation she has not had before, at least in this century, and destroying the British Commonwealth. Headley's interpretation thus coincided with Gaitskill's, and he went on to explain the repercussions for the Commonwealth, as well as the basic flaw in Eden's plan, the successor regime in Egypt. There is a strong possibility that India and Pakistan will withdraw from the Commonwealth if this action goes on, and all the potential African members will follow them. Further, if Nasser's regime in Egypt is dislodged, any government that replaces it is bound to be more hostile to Great Britain than the present one. Unless the British wish to return to the position of virtual occupier of Egypt, and through a position of strength, impose a collaborative regime, what Headley described was true. The successor nationalist government would be more nationalist and anti-British than Nasser's. Headley concluded with a brief comment on the LSE. The LSE has almost ceased to function in the last few days, with the majority of students demonstrating outside the House of Commons. There is hardly anyone in the university world in Britain that supports the government. Again, Headley perhaps underestimated the strength of Tory support in the university community as well as in the country, but I would guess that he accurately described the prevailing student mood at the LSE. While the contention continued to mount, on Sunday, 4 November, Gaitskill replied to Eden on television, "Make no mistake about it, this is war. The bombing, the softening up, the attacks on radio stations, telephone exchanges, railway stations, to be followed very, very soon now by the landings and fighting between ground forces. We are doing all of this alone, except for France, opposed by the world, in defiance of the world." This was the critical day. The Observer offered its readers an apology that caught attention around the world. 5 weeks ago, we remarked that although we knew our government would not make a military attack in defiance of its solemn international obligations, people abroad might think otherwise. The events of the last week have proved us completely wrong. We had not realized that our government was capable of such folly and such crookedness. The protest movement reached its peak in an immense gathering in Trafalgar Square to stop Eden's war. Within the government, Mountbatten drafted a letter of resignation, but was ordered to remain at his post as an active officer in the Royal Navy. The outcome remained in the balance. Julian Amory noted in his diary, "Still no news of any landing of troops." After a period of intense public suspense, British and French paratroops were dropped at the northern tip of the canal at dawn on 5 November. Julian Amory noted with relief, "The troops have at last landed at Port Said." At dawn the next day, the naval bombardment began on Port Said to provide cover for the amphibious operation. Commandos moved ashore and were followed by tanks. Port Said had been captured by late afternoon. An armored column set off down the canal. British and French forces consolidated an area of 25 miles along the canal. And then it was over almost as quickly as it had finally begun. Julian Amory wrote in his diary on the day after the invasion that the air is thickening with rumor. Could it be true that Eden might declare a ceasefire when victory seemed so near to hand? Colin Coote, the editor of the Daily Telegraph, telephoned Amory on 5:45 p.m. on the 6th of November, "You have been betrayed. The government have decided to give in." Amory responded with disbelief and then astonishment. "I could not believe that this was true, but about 20 minutes later, Eden announced that a general ceasefire would take place at midnight." Now, Amory, of course, was writing as one of the leaders of the Suez Group and as a long-standing critic. As a member of parliament, he had some first-hand information, but he was as baffled as most by the sudden end of the story. What, in fact, had happened to make Eden decide to stop? The critical day had been Sunday, the 4th November, when the mass demonstration at Trafalgar Square took place at the same time as two meetings of the Egypt Committee before and after lunch, and a meeting of the full cabinet after dinner. One thing was certain: the United Nations demanded a ceasefire. But one thing was not yet certain: had the Israelis accepted the ceasefire? The Egypt Committee's discussion had an air of contingency about it while awaiting this vital information. Nevertheless, some critical points were made. When Selwyn Lloyd warned of oil sanctions, Macmillan, as has been established by various accounts, threw his hands up in the air and said, "Oil sanctions, that finishes it." Three choices emerged in the discussion. One was to continue, which was Eden's choice, but to make arrangements to transfer responsibility to a United Nations emergency force that would have British and French contingents. The second choice was to postpone further action for 24 hours until the situation at the United Nations and in Israel had become more clear, and to offer Israel and Egypt the opportunity to hand over to British and French troops as an advance guard of the United Nations. Butler and Kimura supported this proposal. The third choice was to postpone indefinitely, and this was a solution favored especially by Monckton. And Eden was nonplussed to learn Lord Salisbury. Eden drew aside Butler, Salisbury, and Macmillan. This conversation has been related with contradictory embroidering, but essentially Eden told them that he could not continue without their support. Butler replied that no one else could hold the government together. Salisbury and Macmillan agreed. At this stage, news reached the cabinet that Israel had not accepted the ceasefire. Clarissa Eden, recording that everyone laughed and banged the table with relief, except for Walter Monckton and one or two others. Against the background of the roar from Trafalgar Square, the cabinet then reached a unanimous decision. The Prime Minister summed up by saying that the overwhelming balance of opinion in the cabinet was in favor of allowing the initial phase of the military operation to go forward as planned. Despite hesitations, members of the cabinet still backed Eden on the day of the invasion. Though Eden had in the end carried the cabinet, he had by no means solved the major problems that confronted him. On the actual day of the invasion, 5 November, the news of Anthony Nutting's resignation, which had been submitted a few days previously, was announced in the newspapers. The official statement alluded to personal reasons, but Nutting's resignation, to many readers, signified not merely dissent from Eden's policy, but an act of courage. It demonstrated that the issue of Suez divided the government and the offices of state, as well as the nation at large. The pressure continued to mount from Washington and the United Nations, and it now increased from the Soviet Union. In a letter of 5 November, Premier Nikolai Bulganin warned of rocket attacks and of volunteers. Eden did not take seriously the threat of Soviet missiles because of British intelligence estimates of Soviet capability and range, but the danger of volunteers, in the sense of guerrillas from Syria and elsewhere, as Julian Amory acknowledged on the basis of his own intelligence sources, was a dangerous possibility of the first magnitude. Eden thus faced a crescendo of opposition at home, as well as from the United States, from the United Nations, and now from the Soviet Union. By the time of the second day of the Anglo-French invasion, the 6th of November, the Israelis had achieved their objectives. They now accepted, as had the Egyptians, the ceasefire. British and French troops had occupied only 25 miles of the canal zone, but the pretext of the invasion had been destroyed. The cabinet met at 9:45 in the morning. McMillan, at this critical time, now reported that the reserve of sterling had been depleted by 100 million in the first week of November. This was a gross exaggeration. The real figure was only 31.7 million. But in any event, McMillan conveyed the point that the run on the pound could spell disaster. The time had come to quit. It is now clear that McMillan was as much concerned with the overall crisis and with his own survival, perhaps opportunity, as he was with the question of sterling. He had been influenced by the resignation of his economic secretary at the Treasury, Sir Edward Boyle, whose ethical as well as political economic arguments had impressed him. McMillan now joined those who wished to halt the operation. In other words, the rebellion against Eden had found a leader, but it was Lord Salisbury who dealt the blow. Salisbury had always supported the commitment to the United Nations and during the crisis had been troubled by the argument that Britain stood in violation of the Charter. Now that Egypt and Israel had accepted the ceasefire, Salisbury insisted that the British defer to the United Nations. Butler agreed with both McMillan and Salisbury. Collectively, they believed that Britain could not continue to defy the United Nations, the United States, and most of the Commonwealth. Eden could not continue without them. He accepted the ceasefire. He was now a broken man. Eden had to accept not merely the humiliation of announcing the ceasefire in the House of Commons on November 6, but also the condition that British and French units would not form a part of the United Nations Emergency Force. The crowning blow was a snub from Eisenhower, who had first invited him to Washington after the acceptance of the ceasefire to discuss the future, but had then reneged. On 18 November, Eden followed his doctor's advice to rest in a sunny climate. He and his wife departed a few days later for Jamaica. Evelyn Shuckburgh, who like most all the rest of those in the Foreign Office had been following these events from a distance, uninformed of the decisions of the cabinet, exclaimed in his diary that Eden had broken down and gone off to Jamaica. This is the most extraordinary feature of the whole thing. Is he on his way out? Has he had a nervous breakdown? Is he mad? The captain leaves the sinking ship, which he has steered personally, onto the rocks. Eden returned from Jamaica on 14 December, tanned, high spirits, but his mood quickly changed. When he entered the House of Commons, the cheers were subdued. When he addressed the conservative backbenchers, the atmosphere was uneasy. According to Julian Amory, he looked pale and drawn beneath the suntan, drank a lot of water, kept his head lowered. He responded evasively to basic questions about the Suez policy. He failed entirely to answer satisfactorily a query about the tripartite agreement of 1950. He said that it was a point that wasn't in his head and that he would have to look it up. The tripartite agreement by which Britain, the United States, and France limited arms and upheld the status quo in the Middle East had been the basis of Eden's policy as Foreign Secretary 1951-55, and to falter on such a basic point seemed to be astonishing. to many conservatives, he had lost his grip. On 20 December, under pressure from Gaitskill, he lied in the House of Commons about collusion. There were no plans to get together to attack Egypt. There was not foreknowledge that Israel would attack Egypt. On the 8th of January, he submitted his resignation to the Queen. I have in these lectures emphasized the connection between Eden in the 1950s and Eden in the 1930s. And I close with a quotation from a letter written by Eden on the eve of his resignation in late December 1956. I remember Stanley Baldwin telling me years ago how very lonely it was at the top. I didn't know what he meant then. I do now. I find it strange that so few, if any, have compared these events to 1936. Yet it is so like. Of course, Egypt is no Germany, but Russia is, and Egypt just her pawn. If we had let events drift until the spring, I have little doubt that by then, or about then, Russia and Egypt would have been ready to pounce, with Israel as the apparent target and Western interests as the real one. Russians don't give away all that equipment for fun. Yet so many seem to fail to see this and give Nasser almost as much trust as others gave Hitler years ago. Nasser was no Hitler, but Egypt, Eden believed, was becoming a client of the Soviet Union. The letter makes clear Eden's steadfast beliefs, which were shared by many of his colleagues. It is no whitewash of Eden to say that he became the scapegoat for a failed policy. His ideas were representative, and his policies were accepted by members of the cabinet. Eden was not a great man, and for temperamental reasons alone, he probably should never have become prime minister. But he was representative of his age. He believed that the British Empire would continue to survive as a commonwealth and that Britain would remain a world power, as did many of his countrymen. He thought in terms of historical analogies of the 1930s, as did many others. He had moral lapses, and perhaps the greatest part of his tragedy is that he betrayed himself and his country not by believing in the rightness of his cause, but by pursuing his goals by methods that he himself believed to be ignoble. He deserved better treatment given to him by his colleagues, and he merits more balanced consideration than the assessments rendered by many historians. Eden must be held accountable as captain of the ship, but Suez was very much a collective enterprise.
I think we have to thank Professor Lewis for a most fascinating and interesting lecture, including his quotation from my colleague, the late Hedley Poole's summing up. Not, I think, altogether accurate of opinion among the LSE staff at the time. The head of his department, Professor Manning, a man of very peculiar and idiosyncratic approach to the study of international relations, and an international lawyer and idealist from the 1930s, was torn every which way, but I do remember him presiding over a meeting of largely of students of international relations at which he attempted to defend Sir Anthony Eden's actions very unsuccessfully. He was, in fact, addressing the wrong audience, as I found when I addressed by the seminar run by the two of Michael Oakeshott's deputies in the politics department. To discover that people who 4 years earlier would have been sitting following the revolution with Harold Lasky had, a result of Professor Oakeshott's impact on the LSE, turned around 180 degrees, and that they were very heavily representative of the newer members of the Commonwealth, couldn't have asked me as an alleged expert why Britain had not proceeded with the invasion of Syria, why they had cut short and so on. It was a revelation to me as to how quickly opinion under the impact of Professor Oakeshott had turned around in the politics department at that particular stage. Among the economists, certainly most of the senior economists, with the exception of James Mead, were in no doubt. I remember there were two petitions in the senior common which we were asked to sign, one condemning the Russian action in Hungary and the other condemning the British government's action in Syria. And James Mead, who had great difficulty in deciding on the moral issues because he could see every side of every debate, was pursued round and round the table by Lord Robbins, who a long-standing colleague of James, both in the LSE and in the Cabinet Office economic section during the war, was well aware what difficulty James had in making his mind up on moral issues at that time. Every time Mead had got himself to the point where he was about to sign one or both of them, Robbins would put in a little word which would set the whole procedure going again. But Robbins and Plant and the senior economists at that time, again, I think, were in no doubt as to where their particular support went. The demonstration in Trafalgar Square on the 4th of November caused one of the very few really humorous letters to the papers at the time, because on the Monday, a letter appeared in the Daily Telegraph from two old ladies, not from Dubuque, but from the English equivalent of it, which ran something as follows, that they had seen that day the most disgraceful sight in the history of the British of Britain. Hordes of foreigners, students, and other types pursuing the police down Whitehall and reviling our noble Prime Minister. And the only thing which made the day memorable was the behaviour of the police and their magnificent horses. And it's nice to know that mood, that, through everything else, that mood in Britain survived, because a fortnight later, I heard the Foreign Secretary of Jordan, having delivered himself to a Chatham House audience of the view that Jordan was the most stable state in the Middle East, at which the well-bred audience in Chatham House was heard to gasp audibly, was tackled by an old lady there to ask him whether the measures were being taken by the Jordanian government to stop the beating of camels. There's something about the British Empire which survived through Suez, and I think it's on that note we should thank Professor Lewis for his fascinating, interesting paper, and look forward to the appearance of the book of the lectures afterwards. Whether it will be followed by the film of the book, we don't know, but that's all we get. Thank you very much.